into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Killer Cereals Podcast. Tony Jones.
Ryan Parker.
We talk about cereal TV that we think is killer, and we come at it directly from the spiritual, theological, truth, and reality perspective. We want to know what's really going on. What's the meaning behind the shows? And we are currently in the midst of a show that seems to be written for us and our podcast, and that's The Path, starring
Hulu.
Starring Aaron Paul on Hulu. And we're tackling episodes 3 and 4. So just to recap, Hulu dropped episodes 1 and 2 off the bat, and then they've been dropping one episode per Wednesday. And so this catches us up. And we hope you're watching it and enjoying this show. The show is about a, if you ask people outside of it, they call it a cult. And if you ask people inside of it, they call it a movement. And I think now that we're into episodes 3 and 4, I think we can forget about spoilers or whatever. Like, we're just going to talk about what happened on the show, because this is a show that, and like, you know, it ends there. There's kind of an old school cliffhanger mentality at the end of the episodes. And for sure at the end of episode 4, it ends with a big.
And I would like to say, too, that just the way we've been doing these podcasts is, you know, it really is meant to unpack. So you're just, if you're listening to this, thank you first. And then if, you know, if you're doing it without watching the show, you know, maybe it, you know, we encourage everybody to watch the show. So hopefully, a side effect of what we're doing is encouraging people to watch some good content, then come back and check it out, see what we have to say about it. Let's just spoil away. Just go.
Yeah, let's spoil it, baby. I want to also thank Hulu, because they've given us, since we started podcasting on the show, they've given us the press kit, and it looks like they're going to give us access to some of the people who are at the heart of the show. So we'll
see how that goes.
Spoilers. Yeah, we're not going to lead you on about that, but it's real promising. You know what's interesting, Ryan? One of the things is you've got this main central conflict in the show is the marriage between Eddie and Sarah, and that's a bit about that last week. Yeah, that's a conflict that I think by episode 4, for me personally, I'm getting a little bit like, I mean, I'm a little bit not I'm just like on the edge of being perturbed by their marriage. Like, I'm on the edge of being perturbed by, like, Eddie makes an advance at Sarah. Sarah spurns him. She says, I'm not ready yet. He says, I'm doing everything. I'm unburdening myself to you. And then she says, I need to unburden myself to you. And he says, no, you don't. You haven't done anything wrong. And then there's this big, deep, dark secret that's at the heart of it, that I think is, you know, a really tricky thing, because the idea is that Eddie has had an affair, but what we know as the viewer is that Eddie has not had an affair.
That's why I think you might be feeling the way you feel about that element of the narrative, because there's tension there, unjustly so.
Yeah,
that Eddie keeps feeling like he has to atone for something that he doesn't, because he's keeping what he really saw in Peru a secret, and it's being misconstrued that he's had an affair with another woman, which he hasn't, and that's leading to. So it's this tension, but it's kind of a false tension, right? There's no foundation to it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I guess I don't have a lot of criticisms of the show, because I really like the show. I mean, it's not only really well done, but it's about a topic that I'm interested in. But if I have an early criticism of the show, it's this old trope that goes back to the, you know, the Brady Bunch. It goes back to like the Andy Griffith Show when Barney Fife has a secret and he won't tell Andy what really happened. And that's the tension of the show. So you've got this Miranda Frank subplot, and Miranda Frank is not only a character in the show, you know, she's from Meyerist, the Midwest branch in Minnesota. Actually, she gets picked up and she gets brought back to the East Coast, where she's basically being held as almost a prisoner.
Yeah.
And neither, so she's saying, I never had an affair with Eddie, these are lies. And Eddie's saying, Eddie's kind of being coy and cagey and won't just come out and say, I never had an affair with Miranda Frank. And then,
By the way, our founder's dying.
Right. He won't say that either, which he knows that Dr. Steve Meyer is dying, but he won't tell anybody. So there's this like, I don't yet know. Here's what I wonder. What's the motivation for Eddie? Why doesn't he just tell his wife, Sarah, I didn't have an affair, and oh, by the way, Dr. Stephen Meyer is dying? Like, I know
that's a good question.
I know he's trying to save his marriage, and he thinks that if he just unburdens about an affair, which actually didn't happen, and then does his 14 days of penance and you know, investigation into himself, that he'll be forgiven and he can move on, because it seems like kind of everybody has transgressed. Like his father-in-law out at the barbecue grill is like, hey, I transgressed, I remember, blah, blah, blah. But when it's my daughter, man, like...
Yeah, I'm going to mess you up. Yeah, if I can stay not high, if I can stay sober for a little bit, I'll get you. No, I think you're right. I think that's a very interesting question at the core of why he's not telling, and maybe that plays out as the series goes. But because there's a lot about him that we learn in that first episode, and he's in Peru, and he has this traumatic experience in the past of his dead brother.
Right.
But,
and then he either sees,
but he has this
Stephen
vision,
Meyer, or he has a vision. Either he actually sees Stephen Meyer, or he has a vision of Stephen Meyer.
The question is, well, it's pretty clear that Stephen's incapacitated. So yeah. the question is, for me, is was Eddie having doubts before he goes to Peru?
Right.
And does that just kind of accentuate those doubts, right? That vision kind of heighten that experience. But I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I don't know that there's a real good answer for that yet, but you know, I think it is a fair criticism.
It's interesting to me that this show has not used any flashbacks. And I thought it would. And now we're four episodes in. So I'm guessing
only flashbacks in the narrative.
Yeah, they're not going to use
flashbacks. They're very brief.
Yeah,
there's a couple where Eddie and Sarah meet. But they're very brief, if they exist at all.
Yeah. So now you got Miranda Frank. Let's talk about some other subplots.
Well, I want to go back. Oh, yeah. Okay, that's fine. No, we were talking right before we started recording, and one of the things that we've noticed and that we like about the show is that one of the producers worked on Friday Night Lights.
Yeah.
So, what I loved about Friday Night Lights, great show, that would have been a killer serial. We said it's a football show. It's a football show that's not about football. And I said that The Path is starting to feel like a cult show that's not about cults. And you disagreed.
I disagree. And here's why. Because I read that interview, or no, not wasn't an interview. It was a blog post, an article written by the showrunner Jessica Goldberg, and she
the link to it in the podcast description.
That's so fascinating, because she writes in there about what it's like to invent a religion, which she did for the show, and so I think the religion, and then in the in the media kit that Hulu sent us, there's a glossary of Meyerist terms,
yeah,
including things like the future, the garden, transgress, realignment. And then they even give us the 10 rungs of the ladder.
I
think like you're right. Maybe she just invented this religion and it's the envelope in which the show lives.
I think so. So what I mean by that is that, you know, if the creators of Friday Night Lights, the series, clearly understood the workings of small town Texas football.
And that was based on a book called Friday Night Lights. Right.
Sure. Yeah. But they all captured, they knew what that experience was like, right? Yeah. And it felt authentic because they could probably speak that language inside and out. And they knew what it felt like to be at a game on a Friday night and to lead up to it. But again, the narrative transcended. It wasn't just about football. So I think what the creators of The Path have done, and Jessica Goldberg and the writers, is they clearly understand cult practices.
Yeah.
But the show's not about what it's like to be in a cult. It doesn't feel like that to me. It feels like it's asking bigger questions. Like it's about belief itself, faith itself, participation.
Yeah, I mean, it's surely about that being in this sect or cult lays bare certain aspects of a person and their identity and their relationships with others. Make for really good TV. So on that note, let's talk about some of these. I'm going to throw some of the subplots at you. Okay. Because there's the main plot of the marriage. Right. And then there are these subplots. So one of the subplots is their son Hawk and his burgeoning romance with Ashley. And one of the things that happens that we've seen just over the course of the first four episodes is he goes from saying he's 15 and he's goes from saying we're told like I can't spend time with a girl. Like I'm not even supposed to talk to a girl like you. And
we can't smoke, drink or chew or be with girls that do.
Yeah. And a girl like you is I'm just going to look here is. She's not quite a possible.
She's ignorant.
She's an ignorant. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's completely outside of the cult. And by the end of episode four, he kind of breaks ranks with his family, goes to a party of high school kids out in a field, and walks right up to her and starts macking with her, which.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is like just after his cousin had told him what you're feeling is hormones. I have sexual feelings too. You need to repress them. Don't you want to be with us in the garden when the future comes?
Yeah.
And he basically is like, boy's got needs. And he goes.
So this is what she says too is their hormones. They're natural, but they're not real.
Oh, right. What's real is the
future. That makes no sense. What's real is this is this kind of restricted existence, right? This this more ascetic lifestyle. I think Hawk is an avenue into yet another discussion of religion and faith and what it means to be a parts of those communities. And it's one that I think a lot of people can identify with. And certainly I can, because the real question is if faith always, or at least religion, right, institutionalized religion is all about, in some real ways, creating borders.
Yeah.
What's inside and what's outside. And what is holy and what isn't, right? So for Hawk, he can't listen to music, like popular music.
Right.
So she gives him the iPad and I'm like, oh, great, this is all we need. Hawk discovering emo. You know, like this is going to make everything better. But it's really interesting because that's really what a lot of people have problem with organized religion is they're saying it's just nothing. It's about nothing more than placing these restrictions on my life. Right.
Yeah.
And what's sacred and what I can and can't do. And so Hawk starts to push against those boundaries, right? He's testing them.
I would say
in ways that no other character is. It's certainly ways that Eddie, his father, isn't, even though he has crippling questions
okay,
too.
Okay, so here's what I want to say. Here's something I want to say, kind of on a broader perspective or something. Those of us who grew up in Christianity of some sort, we grew up with guys like Eddie, who told very dramatic, they had very dramatic testimonies. I was on drugs.
Yes.
I was screwing girls. You know, I almost died when I did this crazy prank, blah, 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 blah. Then Jesus found me. I turned my life around. Now, and then they would say this to, you know, the kids in the youth group. Now, don't go have any of the fun I had. Like, don't drink. Don't do the drugs. Yeah. Don't have sex.
Yeah.
Be a straight-laced kid, because God saved me from all that. And now I'm in college, or now I'm in my 20s. Like, I did all that crazy-ass shit when I was in high school and college. I barely survived it. And now I'm good and, like, do what I did. So here's this kid, okay? His dad lived a secular life. His dad was ignorant of the movement. Yeah. His dad lived a secular life, did all this stuff, like had the sex, did the drugs, whatever. Then gets into the movement, falls in love with this woman who honestly is beautiful and smart and
kind,
and
yeah.
Kind and is a leader in the movement. He falls in love, gets married to Sarah, obviously pretty young, right after he converts. And then they have this kid, and now he says to his kid, "You can't do any of the stuff I did."
Yes.
And
that's
the
interesting.
Kid says, "I want to, like, you know, like, maybe I want to smoke a joint. Maybe I want to kiss a girl. Maybe I want to go to a high school football game."
It feels like, well, he can get the weed from grandpa. It feels like, it feels a bit like he wants to have his Rumspringa. Like, he's Amish.
Exactly. You know? And who doesn't? And this is common across all, not
all
across
faith.
Liberal religion, but across all conservative versions of religion.
And I don't think it's Eddie so much telling him no as it is just as the community. Because Eddie, remember, it says, what's wrong with him hanging out with a girl?
But look at all this also. Twice we've seen Eddie giving his testimony. How many times have we seen Sarah standing up in front of the whole community giving her testimony?
She doesn't have one.
She doesn't have a testimony. So what they do is
that's interesting too.
They leverage the dramatic testimonies of Eddie and then Mary. So here's another subplot I want to transition to. The FBI guy, right, who's undercover, coming into the movement, just checking it out. He's what they call a possible.
Yeah, there you go.
But he's meeting with – so we know the backstory is that Mary's – father has sold her to his friends for cash.
Disgusting. Yeah.
And
that's a powerful test. When she said, I wanted to see what I cost.
Yeah. $10. Okay. So then our FBI agent goes home, and here's what's interesting. One, he's having real doubts about the story of the father. You can see it in his face. But two, he goes home. Now explain this to me. He goes home and he is suddenly more sensitive to his wife, who says, "I think there's something wrong with our infant daughter." So
sick. Yeah, because it goes in one scene. They flip it because you're thinking, "Oh yeah, he's going to show up. He's going to bust him. He's going to rescue Mary." He's all of a sudden thinking,
"He's conflicted.
Maybe they got something here.
Maybe I'm back in the wrong horse."
And that's really good. Yeah.
Maybe I'm back in the wrong horse, and it causes him, I think, to suddenly think maybe all of my snap judgments, all of my initial judgments are wrong, which is what cops do. Cops, when they, and as a police chaplain, I can tell you, when a cop's on a ride along, when they pull a car over at 2 a.m, they walk up, shine their flashlight, they make a judgment like that.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Cops don't do profiling. That's all cops do is profiling.
Yeah.
They make,
so it saves time.
So he's backpedaling and thinking maybe these people are saving Mary from a monster, and I thought I was trying to rescue Mary from a cult.
Yeah.
Which is another interesting subplot. Now let me ask you about one more subplot.
You're on fire, man. Bring it.
My wife and I, speaking of fire, my wife and I went to bed last night and we thought, okay, the one of the founders says she has burned hands. Okay.
Yeah.
Is
it Beth? Is her name Beth?
Yeah, Beth. That's right. Beth is one of the founders. She was there when Dr. Stephen Meyer climbed the ladder in the 70s. Yeah. When he ascended the ladder in the 70s. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He climbed the ladder when they were in Cusco, and as her husband even and Sarah's father even say, as they're sitting out on the deck that night, and the weed was really, really good down there in those days.
Best weed, yeah.
Okay, so we've got it framed up as these guys were all completely baked. She goes after him, grabs the bottom rung of the ladder, is burned, lets go, and now she bears the stigmata.
Yeah.
Okay? She bears
okay,
this.
I'm with you. Go ahead.
Okay? So yeah. Courtney said it's one of three things. Either A, she really did, there really was a burning ladder that she tried to climb and she couldn't. B, she was super high. They were all super high. She grabbed a ladder. But the way she remembers it through her drug-induced haze is that it was the ladder Stephen Meyer was climbing, but it was just some ladder that was super hot and she burned her hands. Or C, she's completely lying. The whole thing is a complete ruse by Stephen, that couple, and Silas. And remember, they end by telling the new, you know, the self-proclaimed new leader of the movie.
Cal.
Yeah. They say, Silas will never believe you.
He'll never back you. Yeah.
And meanwhile, they're going back to their 5-bedroom home in San Diego and right? He calls them out on their bullshit. So my question to you is, do you think Courtney, do you think it's right? Is she right? It's one of those three. Either
it was absolutely.
It was really a mystical experience. She was high, or she's fabricating the whole thing.
Yeah. And those are three ways of thinking about religious experience, right?
Yeah, right.
It's either really, it really happens, it's really true. It's something you've made up in your mind, like you've somehow psychologically, biologically kind of created this thing, and it comes to represent a certain truth in your life, or you're just making all the shit up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. I hadn't really thought about the high factor, that they were maybe just all stoned out of their mind and they formed this story.
Yeah, then they re-narrated it after the fact.
I really like how you're asking these questions about the narrative and where it's going to go and how it bears it out. But I think, again, it's another subplot that is asking questions about religious communities.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas that guy, I actually figured it out. Paul Froese, who we recommended in the last episode, his book On Purpose, he calls them communities of truth. Right. And that's how you people make religious meaning and all this, is that it doesn't happen alone. You have to have a community.
Yeah.
And the Myers movement is a community of truth. Now, it's one that many people would disagree with. But you have to start asking yourselves, in what ways is it more or less true than the communities of truth I've been a part of?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And what ways is it similar or different? One of the things that I liked about that interaction between Cal, it's Beth, and I think Will, the two founders, or two of the founders, is that conversation starts to get at things that are probably a little close to home for a lot of pastors now. How are you going to afford that house and that health insurance when your denomination is dying?
And
what are we going to do?
Ryan, and when you don't know if you even believe this message anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really
enough,
interesting.
Because you've read enough Peter Rollins and Jack Caputo that the whole thing.
You've read just enough to be really dangerous.
Right. So the whole thing is falling apart in your mind, but you still need, like, you got to put
you gotta white knuckle it, baby. Yeah. And Cal says, you know, not only he's going to write the final three rungs of the ladder,
right?
And he's trying to bring this, and we talked about this a lot last episode, that he's trying to kind of legitimize the Meyerism movement and kind of the broader culture. But what's also simultaneously happening, which if you've been in a church at all, ever, you're going to start to see this with Cal. It's not becoming about the community. It becomes about the personality and the cult of personality.
Yeah.
Right. Where he takes over. He says to Beth, I can walk down a street. And basically he says, I can save anybody.
He says, I can fucking convince anybody.
And, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I can
and
walk.
That's just interesting. I'm like, man, you know, ministers like that who just strut, you know, cock of the walk.
Oh,
they're like,
my gosh.
And they say it's all about him. You know, they point upwards, but come on.
We know it's
all about them.
It's true. It's true. I'll tell you, Ryan, before we go, I had another fascinating experience. I sat down with my kids for dinner last night, you know, and my 14-year-old daughter, who's a freshman in high school, she came home and, you know, we sit down for dinner and she says, Dad, have you ever heard of Jonestown? And
wow.
I'm like, she goes, you know that phrase, don't drink the Kool-Aid? That's from that. And
yeah.
I go, oh, not only do it, like, my last name is Jones. You don't think I remember that when I was in grade school?
And yeah.
They were like, the guy's name was Jim Jones. And then, you know, we tell them kind of what the other kids are like, what was that about? So we tell them all that. And you just think, man, oh, man, I'm telling you, it's
a wild world out there.
Yeah, and these things never go away, you know.
And you're leaving. It's funny because how we remember the past, you know. So in the episode when Hawk is talking to his love interest, and she says, "Can you listen to music?" And he says, "No, we can only listen to music from the '60s and '70s because it was more positive." I'm like, that's the most drug fueled, sexed up era. One of the most drug fueled, sexed up eras, and American history, and that's what you get to listen to?
Well, this is fascinating because we're hoping to get Jessica Goldberg, the showrunner, onto the podcast.
Boy, that's going to be fun.
One of the things I want to ask her is, it would have been very natural for you to, when you framed up a religion for this show, for these people to be teetotalers, but from the very first, like almost the opening scene of the opening episode, they're drinking wine at dinner.
And beer.
They're vegetarians, but
yep.
they freely
but they
use
drink.
Alcohol, and they smoke pot in front of their kids. And
yep.
then we also know now there's another subplot that is really going to play out, I think, in episode 5, and that's the use of a drug to get people off of drugs. Okay,
yeah.
So there another yeah. subplot is this rich kid from the suburbs who's getting basically absconded to Peru with his
mom. At the
end
of 4, yeah.
Where they're
yep.
going to meet with Silas
and get clean.
And get clean, but they're going to get clean by using this drug that helps you unburden. And
yeah.
gets to the deepest, darkest parts.
A hallucinogen.
Which is, I mean, it's really fascinating. So,
and that's, you know, another interesting thing that we could ask her about. And then another way to kind of go off on another tangent about some of the implications of the show is the role that hallucinogenic drugs play in religious experience.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they're especially because I was in grad school at the GTU, which is in Berkeley, which is a hotbed of all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And having those conversations and people of faith experimenting with this stuff, saying, you know, that these drugs are unlocking parts of our brain that we don't have access to, and what could it do to our spirituality and those experiences, you know, that has a long history, not very well known. That's another movie right there. We need to write that down.
All right. Well, we want to thank people for listening for sure, because this thing's really getting rolling and,
yeah, and we're going to, we keep saying it all the time, but we're going to get this thing up on iTunes, and I'm going to work on that this weekend. So we'll be back after next week after episode 5. So maybe we're going to post on Thursday. Would be nice Thursday or
do it.
Thursday morning. Thanks for listening, everybody.
You bet.
Thanks,
Thank you, everybody.
Eddie, when you came to us, what did you find? home. The future is coming. Poverty, political instability, terrorism. Everything we know will collapse. I don't want to live for this moment. I want to live forever in the garden that we are creating here together.
What happened on your retreat?
What do you mean?
You've been acting distant since you got back.
You need to know you are everything to me.
Looking into the Myers movement.
I'm putting them on cold watch. How about you tell me something so I know that this isn't a trap?
We don't hurt people.
You sure about that?
We who follow this path, we struggle with our relationship with the outside world. If darkness falls,
we are light.
I'm not gonna blow up my life because of something I don't even know, but I really saw.
You are nothing! You are nobody!
We're telling you to move to the side.
I can walk out on the street and make people believe.
With scarves of red tied round their throats to keep their little heads from falling in the snow. And I turn round and there you go. And Michael, you would fall and turn the white snow red as strawberries.